Welcome to this episode of Saintly Witnesses, where we speak to Catholics across social media that are doing great things across the world and for our community. On this episode, I got James Conwick on. He's going to come on and share some good information about some of the national, local, and major issues at the forefront for Black Catholics and the advocacy that he does to raise awareness for Black Catholic specific needs. So definitely thank him and appreciate his time today for coming on. So thank you.
Hey, no problem, man. I'm glad I could be here to help out.
Yeah, and so how we got acquainted was, I mean, but even before we had the, earlier this year when we did the recording for Fatherhood, like in February or something like that, I had been seeing you around, your name around on like different publications and stuff like that, your advocacy that you were doing. I even seen you do some work on Instagram too. But in the last year, it seems like in 2023, like you just been doing so many great macro level things to bring awareness for the needs of Black Catholics and specifically like young adults too. So why not, who else to speak with who's like a major pivotal player right now? So he decided to come through. So let's start with the first question, which kind of goes into like the intro. Like I just said, you've been involved in like a lot of major macro level advocacy in the church. Explain what made you want to get involved with like raising awareness, fighting for racial justice and like Black Catholic specific needs.
It's actually quite interesting. I didn't start off this way. I've always known that I wanted to do ministry, and I ran from that very hard up until I turned about 31. And then God gave me a vision of what I needed to do. And I said, okay, cool. Show me how to get there. And he was like, okay, I want you to address these issues in church. But before you do that, I need you to tackle this small task. And I said, oh, what's that small task, Lord? He was like, I need you to address the racism in the church. And not just from a Black-white perspective, but from many different cultures that are trying to come to me that feel like they're not doing what's right because it's not a Eurocentric way of expressing. And it's turning my, he said, it's turning my people off. It's turning my people away. And I need you to address it from your perspective first and then make it inclusionary so that other people can express it from their perspectives. That way we can stop losing people to the peripheries like Pope Francis said. So I was like, well, I don't really have a racial justice background. I don't necessarily, the few incidents that I had that had happened to me that I thought was racist, I thought were isolated incidents. And then COVID happened and I come to find out, not only was it not an isolated incident, but it was happening not just to me personally, but our community at large. And it was a bigger, large scale problem that's dated back to the birth of the church in America. And the worst thing, one of the best things about where I'm located in the Archdiocese of Baltimore, which is the first diocese, the first recognized Catholic diocese in the country. But that just means that the history of it here means that it's been going on longer. So, just a small task for God, a large task for mere mortal like myself. So one of the things I did when I said, all right, you asked me to be here. I said, you got to put the right people around me, because I can't, in my wildest dreams, I could do none of this by myself. I've had support from every major Black Catholic diocese that's out there. Shout out, Archdiocese of Baltimore, Archdiocese of Atlanta, Chicago, New Orleans, my friends in New York, in the different boroughs. Shout out to, definitely Black Catholics everywhere. The Catholic Church that has embraced me, and also to the Catholic Church people that I haven't met yet. I thought it was going to be more of a struggle. But the thing is, it's like they say, God doesn't give you anything that you can't handle. I worked in healthcare for 14 years, and the backstabbing and conniving and all the other things that you see going on in the church. Working in healthcare, it's the same way. So I had 14 years of practice doing that. And so when I come into this arena, there are only like one or two things that are super above me. Like I'm not a priest, so I can't consecrate the host, but I am more than capable because I was called and was given the information and always have been pointed in the right direction of what needs to be said when it needs to be said, all under the direction of the Holy Spirit. Very faithful person when it comes to this, because this is not this is not my cup of tea. I mean, I have the lineage and the history, but to be honest, I know I don't have the look. So, you know, I have to go just a little, it makes me go just a little bit harder because I have brothers and sisters that are differently complected than I am, and they can't get into the spaces because they don't have the look. I have the look to get in the door, but I don't have the look to autonomously say, man, from my black perspective, you know, I find myself constantly in a space where I have to not prove, but show up so that people understand that it's not a separate issue. It's all inclusive.
For sure, for sure. And I'm gonna get off track for a moment, but you mentioned something just now, which caught me off guard initially when I first like caught on to who you were, like in 2022. I always thought you were like a deacon or a priest. So as I've grown to know who you are, I'm surprised to know that you weren't a deacon or a priest. Do you get that often a lot by people in the
Yes,
church?
actually, my nickname in one of my friend groups, I'm affectionately known as the Deacon, not Deacon James or nothing like that, just the Deacon. We will it's a calling that's on my life. At some point, I do aspire to that role, but right now, I'm an agent. I'm not an agent of chaos, but I'm an agent of change, and we all know that. Change can happen from within, but within 2,000 years of the church and 1,300 years since Rome took it over, we have not been necessarily represented inside. So, or our representation has been bleached or decolorized so that our impact is less felt. So I have to do it from the outside in. And then I have to find somebody who's on the inside who's willing to push it out. You know, it's I would love to be a member of the clergy, but I'm just like, maybe when I get older, you know, I don't need to be a priest. That's not I look, I've had many conversations about that with God, and he said, that is not your calling, sir. That is not your calling. You know, you can be a deacon because your words get there. And he said, but before you walk away from all of that, remember your baptismal prompt and what you were baptized into. You are baptized into being priest, prophet, and king. So don't let your light, don't dim your light because you're afraid of the shine.
I got you. I just figured that I thought I'd ask. I'm sure I'm one of the first person
No.
who ever mentioned that before. like I mentioned, like you've been doing a lot of talking and speaking and advocacy for Black Catholics and racial justice in the church. So what are some of the opportunities that you had, either like the Archdiocese of Baltimore, state level, local level, and like for the USCCB even?
Okay, so at the local level, we have social ministry convocation or social justice convocation. I've spoken at that. I actively work with the representation that we have with the Office of Black Catholics here in the Archdiocese of Baltimore, as well as any other ministry that'll have me. It's not that I'm bombarding them with the issues of the Black church. It's just one of those things where the Black church has been is generally ignored until it's time for something to change, and then everybody will come sit and watch how we do it, and then they'll co-opt it and make a version of it that's palatable for themselves, and then keep moving. You know, that's not conjecture; that's actual fact. It happens all the time. We are. I do work with different churches. I don't mind going and speaking anywhere. Anybody who'll have me, I'll go gladly and, you know, speak. But I don't just speak to racial justice stuff. I'm very well versed in all of the.
Yeah, you gotta be. You gotta be open to theology, morals, ethical stuff. You gotta have a little portfolio.
One of my mentors said something to me that stuck with me from the time he said it. And he said it about 3 years ago. He said, when I walk my black self into a church, the first thing they're thinking isn't that I'm Catholic. The first thing they're seeing is that I'm black. And that stuck with me, you know, because he said, and then he encouraged me to make sure that I can dot my I's and cross my T's when it comes to these different things, because if not, they're just going to pigeonhole you or typecast you as the racial justice guy. And if that's not the time of the month that they're, you know, the type time that they're on or the flavor of the month, then you're on the outs until you have tragic circumstances like a George Floyd or whatever the world was trying to show us, everything the world showed us from 2020 throughout the pandemic.
Yeah, you definitely can't be limited to just like one domain. You got to be able to go and, like the Great Commission, go into different lanes and different spaces and have those fruitful conversations about topics that are all, you know, related to the human experience, whether it be spirituality, ethical yes. issues, yes. political issues, even sports sometimes.
Even sports sometimes, right?
Yeah.
So that's at the local level. At the diocesan level, like I say, I'm connected with a lot of the Black Catholic churches here in Baltimore, and that keeps me busy. Like I sing on a mass choir. I do all of these different things, kind of just keep my face in the place, because it's always not gung-ho trying to be super Black all the time, but it is important that we are represented in any space that we go to. Another thing is I was a part of a letter writing campaign that went to Rome on behalf of the 6 African American candidates for canonization. I was a co-writer along with the people from St. Anne's Church, which is another Black Catholic church that I have had the privilege of working with.
Yeah, I read about that at Black Catholic Messenger with Ralph.
Yes, yes. Great guy. They are so motivated because it was that motivated a workshop that I did at the Light Conference, which is a Black Catholic liturgical conference. I encourage people to go to that. And the title of it was, "Where Are Our Superheroes?" And our superheroes are our representation, you know. If I could go off on a quick tangent, like I didn't care about any of the Green Lanterns until Jon Stewart came around. I didn't really watch a lot of cartoons because Superman going Superman, Batman was the closest thing we had to a Black superhero. And then here came Static. And I was like, oh yeah, nah. As a teenager, yeah, no, I want to see, how are you going to write for this kid? How are you going to navigate? How are you going to navigate this life that's underrepresented and not talked about often in media at large? You know, it gave me a reason to get back into comic books and things like that, because I wanted to understand. You know, then here comes Star Wars, and one of the most powerful Jedi of the prequel series was Mace Windu. That's Samuel L. Jackson. Come on now, like, you know, that representation matters. So now we get here to our faith, and yeah, you have your Martin DePorres and you're different and you have your vision of the Black Madonna that's coming out of Africa, and that's fine. That's my deep heritage, but that's not my immediate heritage. That's for the people, that's for us as a church collective, but that's not for me who's walked these streets, and then especially these Black Catholic Baltimore streets. And then you have someone like Mother Mary Lang who walked these Black Catholic Baltimore streets. It's a deeper connection because I come from one of those six cities, and if it's another reason why I go so hard, because it's like her, I've known of her cause. I knew about her cause, and I never went to Catholic school. That's how deep it is. I knew about her cause from a young age, and I never went to Catholic school where they're taught it all the time. So it's really real for me. It's a different level when it comes to talking about the saints. Now, on the national level, I've worked with NFCYM, which is the National Conference for National Federation. Look, you get me messed up with all these different acronyms, right? Because I could sit here and throw a whole bunch of them, but those are for the for the it's the youth it's for the youth ministers or youth conference. I work with them. I've done a few things with them. I've worked with the USCCB, that's the Bishops Conference, and their Journeying Together process. I've been a part of the Journeying Together process from the beginning. It's inspiring because the core group of us, and we're young adults coming from every cultural family, have become very fast friends because we all understand that we can't do this one cultural family at a time. And our allies in there that are of European descent are very open to engage, not just engaging for the point of saying, to the point of saying, yeah, no, I showed up. But they're like, no, tell us where we don't just tell us where we can help you. Tell us where we fall short so that we can learn so that we don't fall short again. And that process has exemplified what the synodal process, the synodal process that the church has been under for the last maybe 2 years or so, instituted by Pope Francis. It really has taken a life of its own with us. And it's put me in spaces and places with other people, not just Black Catholics. Now, I've had the pleasure of going to the National Black Catholic Congress. I've been to three, and I've met wonderful people at all the congresses that I've gone to. When you start talking about, oh, we letting this one or we letting that one go to the cookout, that's the cookout. That's the family reunion. That's where, you get a lot of first timers there, but then you get people that you was like, man, I haven't seen you since the last Congress, And one of the things that I've taken from that is that should never be a speaking point because Congress is once every 5 years. So we have to do something so that we can stay better connected in those times. But I found that some of the contacts that I've made, like I met Dr. Ansel Augustine, and I've met I've met some of the young priests like Father Johnny Gibson. I've met some of the older timers like Ronald Landfair, or and I'm saying these names and people may not have heard them. Go look them up. They're about their business. They do the work. And then I've met people who are doing it on a local level like I am in their cities. And I've met a lot of directors from the Office of Black Catholic Ministries from a lot of dioceses. And then you, of course, you meet the different bishops and cardinals and the nuncio and all of these people. And it kind of helps to broaden your network. But one thing my grandfather used to say was, you don't have to speak in every room that you go in, but when you do, make sure that you do have something to say other than hello and goodbye. You don't have to speak, but when it's time to speak, make sure that you have something to say.
That's powerful. And we actually spoke to Father Ajani like not a long time ago, maybe a year ago, when he first was like a newly minted priest out there in Louisiana. So that was a fruitful conversation that everybody should go peep. But I like what you said about, you know, basically, you know, we have these saints of the diaspora, but we also need saints that reflect our own like nationality and like our own experience. Not to say nothing against those of the diaspora who provide for our collective identity, but we have some saints that are unique to us as like Black Americans. They need to be valued and uplifted. So that's a good point. And thank you for highlighting some of your major accomplishments too. A lot of stuff. So in your time in like advocacy in the church, what do you think are some of the biggest obstacles for Black Catholic issues to be at the center of the church?
Black Catholics. Black Catholics are the biggest thing because of the trauma. Yeah. You know, the trauma, I can't just blame it on the trauma because the people are hurt too. But the people have to understand that they don't have to operate in the hurt forever. Mm-hmm. It can be very disheartening when you walk into a room of your own people and you have ideas. And I'm not talking about progress for the sake of progress. I'm not talking about having Cirque du Soleil, the first Black all Cirque du Soleil come to your church or something like that. That's not what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about is gospel music is music to God. Clapping your hands and shouting are ways to give praise. Sometimes I'm telling how old I am now. I used to watch the House Party movie. House Party and House Party 2. Mm-hmm. In House Party 2, they played the song, and in the one song that kid didn't play or sing, and he was like, I came to clap my hands, I came to stomp my feet. I feel the same way when I go to church. Because the Spirit won't move me to do something. It's going to move me to do something. And just because we're Black and it's not the Eurocentric view of what you think it should be, doesn't mean that it doesn't belong in church. Now, I can't speak to you walk in on a walker and all of a sudden you're doing 50 backflips. I'm not going to speak to that because look, if the Spirit move you to do that, first of all, I'm impressed. But that's not why I'm there. That's why you're there. You know, some of it is not that deep. Some of these people are their church life is the only life that has meaning for them. So they are structurally identified by who they are in the positions of pseudo power that they give themselves when they do things in the church. And what they don't realize is that they're being unfair gatekeepers and they turn people away. And that's just coming up in a Black Catholic parish. That's before you get to a national state. That's before you get to another diocesan parish and you walk in, and this has actually happened to me. I walk in and it's time for the sign of peace. This was well before COVID. And I go to shake your hand and you recoil like I'm dirty or something. And I'm like, and then, you know, these are all things that people have experienced. Then you have to fight the fact that they never wanted Black Catholic churches to succeed. When you go to your major metropolitan areas, the first thing any Black Catholic will tell you, unless they go to a predominantly white church, is that they're afraid that their church is going to be closed. I live that reality every day. I represent three churches in East Baltimore. I have a friend who represents another three or four, and he and I talk every day. What are we doing to make sure that when we go to church on Sunday, the padlocks are not on the door? There aren't chains up on, you know, what are we doing? Because they've nickel and dimed us to death. They've overtaxed us. They taxed us based on your dratticum tax is supposed to be a percentage based off of these things and these certain things, right? And they've taxed us based on who we were instead of who we are. So it was unfair. And now that we've paid it off, if you had the money to pay it off, you know, now you're in arrears. Now you're on a slow decline. If you didn't, they just closed you up. And, you know, these are harsh realities. And then you get to the national level and then you don't exist. 3 million, when they did the Pew study back in 2017, 2018, 3 million Black Catholics. That's more than the entire AME church in America. That was more, 3 million. That's 3% of the church global. The church global stands to lose 7% of attendees every year. So somebody asked me one time, if all the Black people just stopped going to church, I said, as long as that number doesn't go above 7%, it will go completely unnoticed. Because we're well within the margin. And they said, well, how do you know? And I was like, well, if I'm slated to lose 7 and I lose 10, I'm going to look. But if I'm slated to lose 7 and I lose 7, I'm not going to look. Even with people railing and crying out in the dark and they said, oh, all the Black people left, or the last of them, they're all gone. Now, Pope Francis would find something to say about that because he's been trying to nurture the church as a whole and bring everybody back. And there are a few special interest people like myself who would have something to say about that. But to just wake up and no, we fought. As long as it doesn't go over, I don't even think it would make the Cardinals meeting, honest to goodness. So starting from the bottom. Yeah, it's not sad. It's a hard reality.
Yeah, it's a hard reality for sure.
Sad would be if there was nobody doing anything to combat it. Mm-hmm. And we are. We are. It's unfortunate that people see this as a grassroots problem when it's not. It starts mm-hmm. at the top. You follow your leadership. We have been the victim of ineffectual leaders at a lower level. So if we can't get past them, if we can't get past those people that I called unfair gatekeepers, then who are we supposed to go to? I don't have $5,000 to fly to Rome on the chance that just to get to Vatican City, and then I don't have an appointment, I can't meet with the Pope. I don't have the money to keep making that trip until I can get there. And I also don't have the support, and I'm not saying me literally, but I'm just saying just your average Black Catholic, I don't have the support to go and make that trip and continue to make and stay there and sustain myself until I can get an appointment with the Pope so that he can maybe hear my issue. You know, I don't know what you look. I don't know what you know about your Christianity, but I'm only fighting to get through one gate. And I already know that's going to be a struggle because how I lived my life. I live my life now for God, but I had a life before this one. So when I get to them gates, I got a lot that I have to answer for. But those are the only gates that I'm fighting to get through. All the rest of them, I'm just going to walk through. While I'm here on this side, I'm just going to walk through. Because whether you want to be an unfair gatekeeper or not, my destiny is not determined by your inability to see what we need to get done.
Mm-hmm. I like how you said that Black Catholics are like the biggest issue, like the biggest obstacle to like progress. I think that's kind of reflective even to like just not just Black people in general, like in America. Yeah. Like we are on, not to say that we caused it, the root cause of our issues, or we perpetuate and maintain it, but through our lack of like collective ownership and unity and like us banding together to address what we need to be addressed, and like shifting responsibility, that sort of does us a disservice. Yeah. And even like in our church, when we think about like the church closures and whatnot, if we all just band together as Black Catholics and said, hey, we're going to create this pot where we fund our own churches and our own schools, we could have potentially self-sustaining schools rather than just focus worrying about the diocese or the bishop allocating XYZ. You can use that money for sure, but if we came together and said, hey, this is how we're gonna save St. Peter's in Third Ward or something like that, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. So one of the things that gets misinterpreted when I say that is that I think that they're the problem. No, I it's not that I think that they're the problem. I just know what it's like to hurt. I know what it's like to operate from a hurt mentality. And one of the things that somebody said to me about working one time was, if you're going to be good at your job, be good at your job. My mother told it to me like this: don't do nothing that you're not going to be good at. But if you're going to be good at your job, be good at your job. Don't be good at your job because people counted you out. Don't be good at your job because people said that you couldn't do it. Be good at your job because you're good at your job. And I said, that's prophetic and almost a proverb. But it's one of those things where people don't think to look into it any deeper, where it's like, okay, I'm doing this job because somebody said I couldn't do it. Now you've proven that you can do it. Now everybody sees that you can do it. Now, how do you go on and do your job now that you have everybody behind you? And everything like that. Now, because your mindset has to change. You're not operating. The only thing, now, if you're hurting from a place of trauma, you're not going to be able to do your job as well because you don't have anything to prove. You don't have, you know, I listen to all of these hard luck stories, and Western culture definitely has a propensity to tell those from the true sense of the definition of romantic is at some point in a romance, there has to be a struggle of ultimate good versus ultimate evil. So if you triumph over it too fast and you don't learn the lesson, you're doomed to fail. If all you do is struggle throughout, then you'll never get, then if you, by the time you overtake it, you'll never be comfortable in a place so that you could go beyond your success. You know, there has to be a place in there where you just do what you're doing. One of the reasons why, like I said, I was able to work the job that I worked before for 14 years was because nobody counted me out. I was just given an opportunity and I made the best of it. I was the best because I wanted to be the best. I wasn't the best because somebody said, oh, you can't do this. But this is the mindset that we as Black Catholics need to understand and envelop and take within ourselves. We're here by choice, not by chance. You know, God didn't put us here by accident. He put us here so that we could affect it, so that we can be effective in our community, so we could be effective in the things that He wants us to do. He didn't choose, you know, somebody will say, somebody like Dr. King or Malcolm X or a once in a lifetime type of talent or voice in the dark, then why were they there together? It, you know, you defeat yourself. You defeat yourself because you're trying to fit yourself into this romantic narrative of what you think is supposed to be. And that's where we, as Black people who were the original storytellers, are falling short because we're being told the story. We're supposed to be dictating this story for ourselves. If somebody else tells it, they're going to leave out the parts that are important so that we can get where we need to go. That's what I say when I say we're in each other's way. Because I have the information. If I know it, my nephews know it. If I know it, my nieces know it. I don't have any children of my own. They know it because if something happens to me and they see an opportunity to make a change to go forward, they can run with it. Now, I have all of this information. If I'm sitting here holding it, what good is it doing if something happens to me? I'm not even saying, like, if I die, what if I go missing? What if I become in a vegetative state? Now, all of this information is sitting up in here in my head and it's not doing anything. You know, you have to, we have to stop victimizing one another by from the trauma that we've had. Yes, my mother, yes, my grandmother tells a harrowing story of how I am, first of all, I'm a third generation Catholic in my church from the first Black family that was allowed to integrate this church. So you got my grandmother, then you have her children, then you have me, and I'm like, yeah. And then my nephews and nieces and stuff. Yeah. So we got four generations here. We have four generations. But if my grandmother decided at some point that that wasn't the move, I wouldn't be here. And I know that I use my church as a backdrop. I'm at my church right now. I'm literally in my church building. I'm not in the sanctuary, but I'm literally in my church building. My church is the backdrop of where I began. I can do none of this without this place. And my grandmother didn't know that I would be doing this because I wasn't born yet. She didn't know, you know, I didn't know. My mother didn't know because my mother was a little kid when she started here. She was like two or three. Nobody knew that by just saying, I'm going to be here. I'm not going to let them tell me this, that, and the third. I'm not going to let them tell me. I'm not going to let them write this story for me. I'm going to write this story for myself. I said, and in turn, gave other people the opportunity to shed their fear and come to church. We have to be that for one another. Yes, I respect your struggle, but we're not fighting the 1960s battle. We're fighting the 2023 battle because that's what it is today.
Yeah, much of things, still the same concept, same battle, same issues, but definitely the terrain has changed and how we approach stuff now compared to the 60s is definitely got to be changed. But I definitely appreciate how you shared that vital wisdom that your mother gave you, sort of like a proverb that she gave. Sounds like something, a piece of timeless wisdom that impacts you a lot today. Yes. And impacts many people in your family. But you touched on this one part. It's going to go to the next question. You mentioned the work that you did with Dr. Ansel Augustine. And so I read recently in the Black Catholic Messenger about the report that young Catholics did, a report that young Catholics published and presented in New Orleans. It seemed like it was a lot of crucial stakeholders at this meeting that you guys were having this presentation with. He laid out a very detailed plan of, like, not only just naming issues and problems, but you also named solutions, practical ways that the diocesan level or churches can implement these solutions. So you just didn't like name a grievance, but you actually gave like solutions that people could put in place. So tell me, what was the rundown of this event and like why you think that type of format was necessary to have?
So once again, I have to defer to the group on this. There was a need, there was a void after the National Black Catholic Congress. And I'm not saying this to get on anybody, and please don't take this the wrong way, but if you don't know what you need, you don't know that you're missing something. So we came together, a group of us, about a dozen or so of us came together just from a perspective, from a perspective viewpoint, where it's like, I'm a Black Catholic, but I don't go to church. I'm a Black Catholic, but I go to church and I participate and I do everything. I'm a Black Catholic, but I'm on my way out. You know, I'm a Black Catholic, but I'm a Sunday only Black Catholic, you know, and all of these different types of viewpoints from different areas of the country, from different, you know, ways of being. You know, I'm a Black Catholic and I've never been to a Black Catholic church. I'm a Black Catholic and I've only been in Black Catholic churches. I'm from, you know, one of the big Black Catholic dioceses or things like that. All of these different perspectives coming in. And the craziest thing about it was, for what you can see on the list, those were the things that we all had in common. Imagine, you know, somebody saying, my Baltimore problems are not your Chicago problems. Your Chicago problems are not my New Orleans problems. My New Orleans problems are definitely not your California problems. And then we get out there and we come in and we sit down and no, your problems are my problems. We're leaving for these reasons. And let me add another little caveat to that. And let me add a little something else to that. And then, and we're sitting here and we're having a conversation about who we are. And we're all the same person from a Black Catholic perspective. And it's like, okay, cool. So yeah, no, we sat there and we had to iron that out first. Create the space. Because before you come in and, well, you're not going to like what I have to say because I've walked this path. No, because what does it mean to walk that path and still walk in the church? Nobody's path, past, or anything was discredited in this process. And we came up with these 20 points, and they were probably closer to 100. But these are the things that, for the majority of the group, these lines cross completely every time. I've never, you know, I could say something like, I've never been to church in California. And then how is it that somebody who's never been to church in California, I said, and I bet you when they were walking out of the church, they did this, 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 and this. And they was like, well, they didn't do that fourth thing, but them first three things you were definitely on. How? Why? Because it's a shared collective consciousness about being a Black Catholic in America. So we came together and we touched on these points. And then we had to look at them and we had to be very realistic. We didn't have to be hard or harsh. We just had to be realistic. That's why there are timelines attached to them. We have to look at it. And then not only that, but who we need to target with this information. So that we can affect the right amount of change. Excuse me. Some of this stuff is diocesan level. Some of this stuff is parish level. And some of it's in the community. But a lot of it is, like I said, it has to come from the top. It doesn't need to be a strict edict or encyclical or anything like that. But what it does need to be is commonplace and an understanding that we're not accepting this as the norm anymore. And you should neither, especially when it comes to a larger organization like a national organization. We shouldn't be begging to, we shouldn't be begging to have a spot at the table as people who hold workshops and keynotes and things like that. And then also, with that being said, just because you put a face that looks like mine out there, that doesn't mean that they represent what I represent. So maybe you get somebody who you are, who is in your opinion, tried and true. And then you get somebody who you only maybe or never heard of, maybe a little bit or maybe never heard of, so that you can get that information, so that you can get more than one perspective. I'm going to get five different Eurocentric or Euro looking people. I'm going to get three or four people who don't necessarily speak the English that I speak or whatever. But when it comes to some of these African-American perspectives, you're going with what you think is safe. And the time for being safe is over. You had a time to be safe. You had a time to fix it while it was safe. Now, I'm not saying it's about to get dangerous, because ain't nobody fitting to fight the Catholic Church. That's just what that is. I'm sorry. But it's going to get, it gets contentious at times just because we have all the tools necessary for this not to be a problem. And you want to ignore it. You want to ignore it for whatever reasons you choose to. That's not acceptable for us anymore. That's the long and the short of what we came from, what we got from that.
I like how you mentioned that no matter the geographical location or whatever, y'all had commonalities and things that y'all practices and stuff that y'all had the same, and y'all could agree upon some key core experiences and issues that resonate regardless of whether you're in the Northeast or the Deep South or the Pacific West, whatever it is. So that was a good little unit that y'all came up with and presented those details to. the stakeholders that needed to hear it. And like you said, it was stuff at the local community level, diocesan level, and even stuff that the national USCCB can implement and to help foster a nurturing church. So even through like all this information that you shared, like what you speaking about anti-racism and you talking about theology and even all the topics that you know and you can like defend, what are some of the things that you hope audiences get from you when they hear you speak?
The church isn't dead. It's going through a transition. The last time, well, if you pay attention to history, the church goes through cycles like this, down cycles and stuff. Luckily, we're not a live by the sword type of luckily, we're not a live by the sword type of society, you know, like certain feudal eras and things like that. But anytime somebody's talking about being anti-racist, you know, or welcoming, or just being welcoming of culture into spaces, yes, there should be a degree of not necessarily caution, but awareness of what's going on. But let the Catholic Church live up to the promise of being what the word Catholic means, which is universal. We are. I love one of my one of my favorite things to say is we have a chance to do the right thing. Let's not be on the wrong side of history with this. It's been too many times, especially from a Western perspective, that they've had the opportunity to do the right thing and they went in a different direction and it's caused more heartache. And then when another group was affected, that's when they made the change. That death is not a benchmark for change, should never be. Pain shouldn't have to be a benchmark for change. Another wise quote that I was given was, when you see change coming, change. Don't let the change happen to you, because then it becomes uncomfortable and you can't do it on your terms. When you see change coming, change. This is where the church is now. It's changing. We're not in the dark ages. We are in an information age right now where we can look up and see that it's been bad for people. That's where we are. The church isn't dead. It's not dying. It has wonderful sustainability because of the Eucharist. Don't give up on the church because of the foolish machinations of a few people who don't necessarily get why they do what they do or have very little spiritual connection to the religion as a whole and things like that. So, you know, stop letting people, because they hold a title, tell you what it is supposed to be. Like I said earlier, we were all baptized priest, prophet, and king. That's men and women. I ain't never heard no girls abridged version of a baptism. So stop discounting and discrediting people and calling it and saying that it's based on the faith. No, that's based on you trying to diminish someone else so that you can keep whatever semblance of power it is for yourself. Let go and let God. That's the only true authority in the church, unless he gives you authority. None of these words, regardless of how long I talk, are mine. They are his, because I really could rather. I love what I do because I love helping people, but not in so much that I would be that this would be the first thing that I would want to do. I want to preach, but I can't do that comfortably. How I preach and how I want to do it, I can't get to until we've gone through what I'm trying to get us through. I've already had the conversation. I already know. This is not for those who doubt. Hey, look, Jesus picked 12 homeboys. Jesus picked 12 homeboys. The number one homeboy denied him to his face. He didn't deny him once. He denied him three times. His number two homeboy sold him out. And then his number five or number seven homeboy, wherever Thomas fits in there, denied that he could have possibly come back. And he handpicked these people. So I'm not fazed by people not believing in the power of the conversations that I have with God, because those are for me anyway. But just know, I would rather be on the right side of that than on the wrong side of God at any time.
Yeah. And when you when you put it like that, when Jesus had homeboys and partners, it kind of sounds, it's real eye-opening. from like an urban Black perspective, like, dang, Jesus had homeboys and partners with him, man. He had a whole clique with him, a whole squad.
Man, 12 folks. 12
yeah,
folks.
Yeah. But and to your point, though, about the change, something I've noticed at the Catholic Church, not only been Catholic maybe since 2018, Easter Vigil 2018, in times of like great assault, whether it be ethical, moral, the church tends to like shrink and like hunker down more on like theology and like the religious explanation. It just reverts back to like this is our core, this is our faith, we believe this, rather than even like entertaining the idea of like, hey, there's some truth in this movement, or there's some truth in this philosophical movement, political, social movement that's going on that you need to possibly engage with the world with and like engage in a dialogue conversation with, rather than just, well, we believe X, Y, Z, and we gonna ostracize and just even neglect entertaining this movement, group, idea, whatever. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
You ever think about that? You see that before?
So it's funny you should say that, because the church, the church was founded at the edge of the sword.
Mm-hmm.
They put Jesus on the cross that scattered the flock. So who was supposed to come after him? His handpicked. So we know that Judas wasn't there for them. So then it was the 11. Okay, you got the 11. Of the 11, 10 of them were put to the sword. So that put, you know, that put people at a disadvantage. They were dismayed. So they were like, well, what do we grasp? What do we hold on to? And they will hold on to the teachings and we will come out. So they moved on. And then they got into a place where they had expanded exponentially, because think about it. When we start talking about, especially in the Easter time, after Easter Sunday, before Pentecost, they say, and 5,000 were converted that day, and 3,000 were converted that day. The growth of the church has never been a problem. It's just when you start trying to consolidate instead of expand. They're like, well, you know, they're killing a whole bunch of us, so we're going to consolidate. We're going to kind of pick up and we're going to move someplace else, and we're going to, and it's like, no, you're not supposed to do that. The church, the Catholic Church especially, has probably been driven to the point of extinction probably at least four or five noteworthy times throughout history. But whether it's common knowledge or commonplace, it doesn't change the fact that you cannot turn in on yourself. If your house was burning down, and you see the results, and I apologize to anybody who's had to live with that trauma and that tragedy. People are so afraid of going through it to get to the other side, that they curl up and then they perish under whatever circumstances that they are. And the church doesn't realize that this is not the way. They're doing it again. And it's like, okay, well, then God is just going to come save us. The truth is, that's probably right. Actually, no, the truth is, it's absolutely right. Because at some point, we're going to have a breakthrough. And that is usually what saves the church and helps us to grow in number and, you know, things like that. We usually get saints out of those things and everything like that. But the church turning in on itself has never been the answer. And for the times, that it has happened, Jesus has let us know that that is not it. The first time the church turned in on itself was when the 11 were in the upper room and he showed up and forced them out.
That's a good point right there.
You know, you know, if they're just looking for him to show up, they can just go out. That's my thing. Like, I can't sit here and curl up when you're attacking my brother. That doesn't mean I'm going to attack you, but you're not going to keep attacking my brother. I don't know what all that entails, but you are not going to continue to attack my brother. That's the mentality that we need to have. We have to go through it. Jesus, God, what's the point in Advent? And they keep telling us, make smooth the path, make the crooked road straight, load the mountains and the hills, right? Fill the valleys so that there's a straight place to walk forward. Walk which way? Forward. The only way to it is through it. And I think that the church as a whole needs to be reminded of that. That what we hear in church on Sunday is not conjecture. It's actually the framework of what needs to be done. When you're grasping at straws, like, I don't know what I'm going to. What does it say? When people were faced with this in the Bible, what did they do? They went through it. They had no choice. Well, I guess we can try. No, it's not trying. It's doing. You're going to lose some people along the way. If I could touch on something personal, this past summer, from maybe the end of July, no, from the start of August until October, I lost 11 family members. I can only say that God has been with me every step of the way. Because there's no way James Conway could have gone through that and still be here speaking to the glory of God's church here on earth and why we need to continue to come together so that we can build up and go get God's people. James Conway can't do that without God. I cannot do that without God. I am nothing without him. And I'm not talking, you know, and somebody will say, well, you know, it might have just been a cousin or something. No, I mean, truly horrific circumstances for some of these. And the last person who passed was my father. So these weren't abstract, distant cousins or a friend of a friend or something like that. These were people that I regularly conversed with and had real ties and relationships with. That doesn't make me any, and I love the fact that somebody's going, oh no, it doesn't make me any better or any worse than anybody. Look at people in war-torn parts of the world. My story is no better or worse than theirs. My story is just that. It's my story. But if you were to take something from my example, take that there is nothing that I could have done. Sitting in the house, moping and crying. Don't get me wrong, I'm gonna cry. Why? Because I can. Your tears are some of the most powerful things that you have. If you understand how your body works, you know that you can't force out a tear. You have to, your body goes through chemical processes and things like that so that you can cry. It's the same process that your body goes through when you sweat. Now, if I could cry some of this fat off me, that would be great. But, apparently I'm supposed to be big for a reason. So I'm just going to let that one go. But it's more so about who you're trying to define yourself as. The church has a definition of what it thinks it should be, but it's finite. Somebody once told me to define love. I said, you can't define love. They said, well, why can't you? I said, because putting a definition on love sets limits on what love can be. And they were like, well, what about the bad things that come with love? I said, you never heard all's fair in love and war? I said, think about all of the things that God has done because he loved us. I say probably about 90% of it you wouldn't approve of. And I still ain't won the lottery yet, and I'm still trying to figure that part out. But all of that aside, we're trying, it's not about an individual as much as it is about the collective. But if our leaders keep turning in on themselves, then we have to go get it for ourselves. Because it's still salvation is out. Salvation is yours, says the Lord. It is out there to be grasped. How do you attain salvation? Well, you profess that the Lord your God, the Lord Jesus Christ, is your God and Savior. And you will be saved.
Definitely
At
good
that
points. Oh.
profession, everything else you do is you can do anything with God. I'm gonna end it on that before I get to preaching this stuff. But you can do
Nah,
anything with God. You can do anything with God.
you already
Just
was, man.
yeah.
You said you lost 11 family members in a span of a couple of months, and so sorry to hear that you lost some significant family members, and people try to minimize and trivialize your relationship with them. But like you said, it's only through the grace and power of God that you're able to stand here today as a stronger person. So I'm glad to hear that, that through faith and your own personal journey for healing and recovery, that God was able to play a pivotal part in that.
Yes.
But I wanted to end up on a lighter note.
Cool.
I know you from Baltimore. So I'm saying that because my favorite TV show is The Wire. What's your favorite sitcom or TV show, man? When I first saw
Man.
it, I came to The Wire late in the game, but when I first saw it, I had to watch all five of the seasons, and working in education, the season four with the children was like one of the most realest things I ever seen. And even kind of paralleled some of my own journeys as a young Black youth in Houston. So what you think about your show?
My show, the Steve Harvey show. The original Steve Harvey show, not the talk show where he was talking to the people and all that stuff. I'm talking about the one
Yeah,
where
when he was
he
a
had
teacher
that,
with Rochelle and
where
them.
he was a teacher and it was him and Cedric the Entertainer and all of them. Man, that's my show.
Yeah.
Between that, In the House with
With LL Cool
LL Cool
J.
J and The Big Bang Theory, because I'm a big nerd.
Yeah.
But Steve Harvey show, I started watching it again. I found it on, I think it's on Hulu, all six seasons on Hulu. And I was sitting there and I was watching it and I had to stop because I was watching it with my nephew. He's seven. And he started walking around calling himself Big Daddy. And I was like, yo, I need you to chill. But it was a lot of lessons,
Yeah.
We miss, I miss the golden age of TV, especially Black TV with your shows like Martin, The Cosby Show, Living Single, A Different
Amen.
World, Amen.
That's a show. That's
Even
a show. Yeah.
the show Amen with Sherman Hemsley, Fresh Prince, all of these types of shows where, yeah, we're going to get a laugh. But we're going to learn something. We're going to understand a different dynamic of a different part of life. Not show like Family Matters and stuff like that.
It was sort of moral cultivation in the TV show.
I think one of the hardest things I ever read was about, and when I say hard, like it was difficult to read, was about good times and how they killed the father character off because they wanted, I think they wanted him to leave his wife or something like that. Just, and they was like, nah. And then, you know, just to break up the home to add to, I guess, the misery or whatever. But then they were going to upplay Jimmy Walker's character. And it was going to be, it's essentially what they did to Family Matters with Steve Urkel. Because Steve Urkel was a once in a generation type character. I watch a lot of black TV, man. It's crazy. But he was a once in a generation type of character. But if you look at it, Steve Urkel was just the smart version of Jimmy Walker. Every person that didn't have a natural storyline with Steve didn't make it. If you saw the original layout for Family Matters, the woman who played the aunt, she was the big ticket. She was the big ticket actor on there. She was the person, what was her name? Thelma Hopkins, wonderful actress. She was the big ticket name. She was the person that was supposed to draw the people in. As a matter of fact, Jaleel White wasn't even an original cast member. He was supposed to be a one-off character.
Yeah, I was going to say that at the end. I was going to say, like, in the original Family Matters, after seeing this on documentaries, like, he was just supposed to be like a super, super side character, supporting character. But the audiences saw him like a super powerful. And so they just made him, his arc more and more, like, prevalent in the show.
So much so that he became a member of the family and everything like that. And it's just like anything else. Like, now, see, in Good Times, if you just watch it from start to finish, you start with that family of five unit, and then they killed the father off. Then the mother left, and behind the scenes she left because she was sick of the JJ stuff. It was always kid dying on Mike, you know. It was this, it was that, and it was just too much. And then come to find out you couldn't build a show around somebody unless you had a strong moral compass there. She left for almost an entire season. And then when they brought her back, they tried to get her with the okie doke. You know, she was, you know, she now she's a working mom. Now she's this, she's that, and she's this. And they're trying to navigate life. They're trying to navigate life for the day to day. And how it ends up ending is them moving out of the projects. But why couldn't they move out of the projects when the father was going to make a way for them? How many black stories are that? Are they, you know, they couldn't, you know, they're trying to move out of the inner city and he's about to move them to another location and it could have been better for them, but you can't up and move an entire family or setting or place. And I'm like, I mean, outside of one or two things, you was only ever in their apartment or the apartment across the hall. So you could have done anything with that, changed it up any kind of way. No, they wanted to tell their story. And that goes back to what I said, like, do I love Good Time? Yeah. But then when I saw that, that was a hard read for me. Steve Harvey, every show has their behind the scenes background stuff, you know, all this craziness and stuff like that, right? But Steve Harvey's show on air was very clean cut. Even, you know, it was everything you needed it to be when you needed to be it. It was dealing with young people at various stages. It was navigating adult relationships. It was understanding the change of the time based off of my lived experience and what we're going through now. It's not by any means a perfect show, but it's just one of my favorites.
Yeah, and as an educator too, I think the invaluable role that him and Cedric the Entertainer played at being a powerful Black influence in a, Black and brown school with so many students that reflect their likeness, and instilling within them, like you said, that moral guidance for discernment and empowerment, and like even like identity affirming in their own unique way, though it wasn't like flawless, but in their own unique way provided so much like personal insight to the characters that it was helpful. But I definitely think that's a good point though. Like TV now, Black TV shows or just TV shows back 20 years ago used to have like a sort of moral, 30 years ago used to have like a moral cultivation element to it. Now it's, I'm not sure if it's still present. I'm from the TV shows I watch, I don't think it's there that much, but I
I
feel
can't
like
think of a black show today.
I mean, I've seen it's a Black show with Mike Epps and the girl from Tootie from on Netflix, the Upshaws, but it ain't necessarily like it's in the like
Yeah,
the
like
it's in
so.
the line of Family Matters, but it's not like hard hitting with like PSA announcements and good moral drug abuse lessons and stuff like that. Yeah, that's what I would think.
I mean, like I take my hat off to like the ones who have started their own network and all this other stuff. Yeah, you used to see them on YouTube, but they're hitting the cultural aspects and not necessarily the moral.
Right. So like a lot of the
And
TV shows right now, a lot of TV shows that have come out like on the prime time show have definitely hit on like, same sex children and all these other things, but not necessarily like the moral development aspect.
I'm like, you have like you're a teacher, right? You're in education, right? Imagine having all of the tools necessary to teach an amazing class, and you go in and sit down and hand them a worksheet. That's exactly what it's like. And it's like, okay, they can get it from this worksheet, or you could have an amazing class experience and touch the lives of your students as they are. And that's what I get from a lot of this culture-based TV. Yeah, no, I understand it because I've lived it. And the only thing that you're teaching these young people is that they can live it too? No, you teach them that we lived it because we had to. And if you can do better, help somebody. You know, I think that's the, you know, and I think that's, you know, it's crazy because you pitch a show like this to a major network. And the major network is like, you know, well, where's your old black Negro for the wisdom piece? And they're like, man, we don't need that. You know, they want it. They want you want the funny. This is the funny, you know, da 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 da. And then you get your old black Negro, and he's the funniest of the funny, you know. And I'm just like, you know, where's my Jamie Foxx? Where's my Jamie Foxx show? Where this kid has all the talent in the world, but because he can't get out of his own way. And he doesn't see himself because he won't let his ego just dissipate so that he can just do his job. Think about all the opportunities Jamie had to be great. And he messed it up on his own every time. That's us in a nutshell. And then what makes it even better is they don't let him, there's not an episode that goes by where they don't have to check him on that. You know, Martin was a lot about the culture, but it was a lot about self-correcting in a society where these are your immediate friends, people that you deal with, co-workers, things of that nature, and you're not going to get it right all the time, but you need a support system, you need a team, you need your group, somebody to have your back. You get a show like The Cosby Show. And they said, that's an impossible standard. No, it's not. The impossible standard, I would think that an impossible standard would be living paycheck to paycheck when you had the opportunity to go to school and you were like, yeah, no, I'm not going to do that. You know, these are all things. And honestly, this is the type of stuff I talk about when I'm talking about how we as a community, a cultural family, can progress in the church as well as in life because I was raised by TV. My mom was around. My mom was around, but my mother was also in the military. So sometimes she wasn't around. So I have, and I spent a lot of time with my family, and we had to navigate these different cultural and familial structures, and we could see it playing out on TV and stuff like that. And it was like, and now that we're older, I have such an appreciation for how they could sit here and it was like, yo, there was a rat in the house and we moved. And you hear somebody say it now, and it's like, no, you moving because you chicken out. And it's like, no, we had a rat in the house and we moved because we did everything we could to get rid of the rat in our house. And I'm like, man, the 60s and 70s was a wild time, boy. And they were like, yeah. And it was like, so now we know. So just to, and it's one of those lessons where if you've never been in that situation, you don't know that if you ever had that type of a situation, that these things bring a trail so that others can follow. And I'm like, ain't no exterminator telling you this stuff because they try to make the money,
Right, right.
all of these different things. And it's just a testament. One of the things I like to tell people, especially when I'm ending, is I love being black, not because I think I'm better than anybody else, but because it navigating this landscape gives my life a different type of joy. The only time that I don't feel the joy is when people don't share the love, and the only time they don't share the love is when they're trying to benefit from me at cost to myself. That's it.
That's a
And
good
that's
one.
really what racism is in a nutshell. People trying to benefit from you at the cost of you.
That's a good point. And you shared a lot of good points about some good high quality black sitcoms and just the overall experience of black TV. And I'm glad that you are a big fan of black TV too, man. Black TV is wonderful. So much more could be said. But I'm going to end it on this note. But I really appreciated you, James, coming through and getting a second opportunity to meet with you face to face. I really appreciate the conversation that you had and all the beautiful and wonderful detail that you shared about your advocacy and your awareness work that you do in the church and in the community. And I pray that the work that you do continues to grow and be fruitful as you engage audiences on like difficult and challenging content that they need to hear.
Oh man, I appreciate you having me. Thank you so much. I tell everybody this, man. I wish you much success on your platform. If you ever need me to come through again, I will gladly come through again. I take a quick few seconds to plug some of these organizations. St. Winston's Laws Church in Baltimore. Born and raised not in Baltimore, but my spiritual journey began here and they raised me. So St. Winston's Laws Church in Baltimore is always going to get it. Also, the East Baltimore Pastorate, which is St. Anne's Church in East Baltimore, St. Francis, the historic St. Francis Xavier Church, which was one of the first black churches in the country where they allowed shouting as a form of praise. And it's still that today. Also, one of the oldest, if I'm not mistaken, was the first Black Catholic Church in Baltimore City proper. And then, of course, once again, St. Winston's Laws, my church is one of those churches. Shout out to the Archdiocese of Baltimore, who has let me operate within their framework. I do my best to not embarrass anybody. If I'm gonna embarrass somebody, I'm embarrass myself first. And since I don't embarrass, I'm good.
Nah, man, you put on for your city real good, man.
Yeah, man. Definitely. Shout out to my homeboy, Rudy Dehaney, who helps keep me in this space. Dr. Ansel Augustine, who has been one of the best mentors that I could ever hope to have. Shout out to my folks at Catholics United for Black Lives, CUBL, wonderful organization of people. Some of the best people I've worked with. Shout out to the people with Journeying Together. From the USCCB, and Meet Me at the Well Ministries, Eat the Scroll Ministries, Anchored in Christ Ministries, and the soon to be coming up Conway Ministries stuff. I'll be should be dropping. I will We will be starting Conway Ministries, which is starting with myself in 2024.
Oh man, that's definitely much anticipated right there. You starting your own, you continuing the work that you do, but in a new platform and medium, that's going to be Some live right there, man, to really pay attention to, I'm sure. I'm not even gonna ask what it's gonna entail. Just have to wait and see and scrutinize
Correct,
that
correct.
real good.
Yeah.
But a major shout out to all those people who enable you to speak your mind and speak for truth and justice in the church, and also for the dignity of everybody. I think that's at the core of like everything that we do. It's just like the human dignity and sacredness of life. Well, you guys pray for James and the work that he does, and you guys can tune in to next episode.